Today is Thursday, July 2nd.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the World Health Organization is warning of dire consequences for nations that don't take all actions to stop the spread of the novel coronavirus.
We will never get tired of saying that the best way out of this pandemic is to take a comprehensive approach.
It's not just statues memorializing America's slavery past that activists are demanding be removed.
This is about who we are and what we stand for. When you put something in stone, when you put something in bronze, it lasts.
Also ahead, Broadway may not be live in person, but it will soon be in millions of people's living rooms. It's all on today's International Edition. Anxiety over the coronavirus is rising among Americans, along with a number of new COVID-19 cases in the country, with a U.S. death toll of more than 127,000. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, in a briefing Wednesday, said nations who fail to use every mechanism available to combat the still raging virus will struggle to beat it.
We're concerned that some countries have not used all the tools at their disposal and have taken a fragmented approach. These countries face a long, hard road ahead.
California, Texas, and Arizona have emerged as new U.S. epicenters of the pandemic. California Tuesday saw its highest single-day increase since the start of the pandemic. There has been strong reaction by the European Commission after the United States secured nearly all of drug maker Gilead's three-month production supply of antiviral remdesivir. The U.S. stockpile of one of only two drugs known to effectively treat COVID-19 did not sit well with the Commission. The move is stirring up the global debate about equitable access to drugs and accessibility. Joining us now for more on what could further escalate tensions between the U.S. and EU nations is reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, it sounds like leaders in Europe are pretty angered by the U.S. actions on this drug.
There is complete consternation right across Europe that this has happened. It had been felt, certainly the last couple of months, that the world was coming together, that it wasn't just Europe and other parts of the world that were dealing with this pandemic, that this is a pandemic that everyone is working together. So the news that this particular treatment, remdesivir, that all of the treatments could have been bought up by the US government has really left people dumbfounded. Yes, it is just a useful tool. It is not a vaccine against COVID. But the fact that this has happened once again, this idea of America first, has really just left people wondering, gosh, what else could be around the corner? Talking to officials across Europe, the head of the Danish Medicines Agency has said that it's strange and quite inappropriate that a company would sell their stock to only one country. I mean, at the moment, it does look as though there is enough for some European countries to make it through the summer. But if the second wave comes, as is predicted in Europe, then there would really be shortages. So there is this concern, and that this is just the worst news at a time when Europe was starting to feel as though we were coming out of the COVID pandemic.
And Catherine, this isn't the first time during this whole pandemic that actions taken by the United States have caused controversy in Europe.
You're quite right. It is worth remembering that back in March, French President Emmanuel Macron got wind of news that the French drug firm Sanofi was going to give the US its first choice on a coronavirus vaccine, because Sanofi said that the Americans had put in some $600 million towards its research and development. There was enormous outrage in France over that. The head of Sanofi was called into the Elysee Palace, and it took quite some time and a lot of arguing before Sanofi withdrew its America First policy. So yes, there is a sort of precedent for this, and there's a precedent for the drug company to backtrack. Also, let's not forget that in the wake of that Sanofi scandal, the European Commission approved a 5 billion euro scheme to support research and development into the coronavirus, into combating the coronavirus, because it felt that it actually had to find its own way out of this crisis, that it could no longer rely on America, and America, which for lots of other reasons has been moving away from being part of sort of the go-to country for Europeans for when it came to wanting an ally.
So is there a plan across Europe to deal with what could be a second wave and not enough of this critical drug?
The only other possibility that we could be looking at for European nations to get hold of supplies of remdesivir if the second wave does happen would be under this agreement known as compulsory licensing. Now, under that international agreement, small, poor countries are allowed to bust the patent. They can make their own. Now, the question would be whether some of these smaller, poorer countries would indeed bust that patent, develop this drug, manufacture this drug, and sell it back to Europe. That would certainly be one possible way of getting around it. But again, we're looking at there being the problem that this is a pandemic, the world is meant to be coming together, and America first seems to be the way it's going when it comes to drugs that not only are for the treatment of coronavirus, but also for the possible vaccine.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much for being with us. Some governments in Europe and also Asia said Wednesday that they do have enough remdesivir, at least for now. Something data crunchers have noticed during the coronavirus pandemic. In an interview with Fox Business Network, President Donald Trump called intelligence assessments on Russian bounties to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan a hoax. For the latest, VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports. In a highly unusual move, the Vatican has summoned both the U.S. and Israeli ambassadors to express the Holy See's concern about Israel's move to extend its sovereignty to Jewish settlements in the Jordan Valley in the West Bank in coordination with Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has plans to start annexing part of the West Bank, possibly this week. Palestinians want the West Bank for their future state. The Trump administration helped draw up a blueprint for the annexation, but some in the American Jewish community say they don't agree with the plan. Joining us to talk more about that part of the story is New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch. I know that you are releasing a brand new film to make your point. Tell us why you felt so strongly about it that you decided to do this.
Well, not only is not everyone in the American Jewish community in support of annexation, not everyone in Israel is in support of annexation. Recent polls over the last few days show that a majority of Israelis oppose annexation. One of the challenges is only a small percentage of Israelis who were polled report that annexation is a particularly important topic to them. In other words, they're not paying much attention to it. It doesn't really matter much to them. They sort of see it as political theater, and there are other pressing concerns, a pandemic, an economy in trouble because of the pandemic, the security concerns Israel always faces. There are many things on their mind other than annexation. In the American Jewish community, that divide is even more stark. And here, the Brookings Institution just put out results of a poll they did 2 days ago showing that Democrats overwhelmingly in the 70th percentile oppose annexation. Over half of independents say they oppose annexation, and a significant group of Republicans also oppose annexation. Altogether, most Americans oppose annexation. So the idea that there's any kind of united front about this issue in Israel or in the global Jewish community is not only dubious, it's incorrect. There is a big divide.
What is the main concern as to why people are opposed to it?
In 1967, Israel occupied the territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and it annexed East Jerusalem. That was not recognized by any country in the world and still has not even been recognized by the Trump administration, despite it recognizing the application of Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights, which Israel also captured during the 67 war. But it never applied annexation to the West Bank. And the reason why is because there's 2.5 million Palestinians who live in that territory. That's the territory that in every round of every peace negotiation since 1967 is intended to be the majority of a Palestinian state. And the two-state solution is what the government of the United States, the current right-wing government of Israel, the European Union, the international community, the Arab states, the Arab League all say they support. So one of the reasons why annexation is so divisive and so opposed by so many people is because it would stand to obviate the possibility of that two-state solution ever coming to fruition in any way that is real. That is to say, you can call small, isolated Palestinian communities and cities that don't have any ability to govern themselves beyond sort of the basic civic, you know, trash collection and electing the mayor, where freedom of movement is controlled entirely by Israel. International relations are controlled entirely by Israel. You can call that a state, but it's not a state. It's a Bantustan. It's a pseudo state. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in that poll I mentioned from the Brookings Institution, they asked Americans, would you call something like that a state? And they said, no. Americans said, that sounds like an occupation. So the problem with annexation is, A, it obviates the possibility of a two-state solution. If Israel annexes significant land in the West Bank, you don't have a viable contiguous Palestinian state that can emerge. B, annexation obviously puts those 2.5 million Palestinians in a terrible situation. Some Israeli leaders, including the leader of the Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz, who was the opposition but who has gone into government with Mr. Netanyahu on the basis of a coronavirus emergency unity government, right, which is now pursuing annexation, Gantz says, well, any land that we annex, any Palestinians who live in that land must receive full and equal rights. Let's put aside for a minute whether the Palestinians want that or not. But the prime minister says, no, they will not receive equal rights. So the second problem with annexation is that it puts Palestinians in a permanent state of non-citizenship. And there are words for that, but they're not in Hebrew or in English, they're in Afrikaans. And the third problem with annexation is that if Israel does enter into permanent legal overlordship of 2.5 million people who it controls but doesn't give the vote to, Israeli democracy has been fatally and fundamentally compromised. So in every respect, it's a bad idea.
So tell us about the film.
So this is a really complex issue, and often mediums like film are a great way to pick them apart and understand them better. And we were fortunate that Mandy Patinkin, who has a great voice, was so excited about joining us in this project. So you can go to StopAnnexation.com, and in 7 minutes, you can get a full and thorough understanding of what annexation is and why it's so dangerous to Israelis, Palestinians, and the rest of the world.
New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch. Top business executives in the United States are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass bipartisan policing reform before its August recess in the wake of protests against police brutality and racial bias in the criminal justice system. For over 160 years, a statue of the 7th U.S. President, Andrew Jackson, has stood in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., but now people want to tear it down. Last week, protesters tried to do just that to the Jackson statue, which has stood outside the White House since the 1950s. VOA's Jason Patinkin takes a closer look at Jackson's complicated legacy around race and democracy.
Hey, hey, ho, ho! Andrew Jackson, let's go!
The statue shows Jackson in military uniform sitting atop a horse with its front hooves raised in the air. The protesters wanted to pull down the statue because of Jackson's brutality toward Native Americans and because Jackson owned black slaves. The protesters failed after being attacked by police, but the statue is now a flashpoint in a wider debate in the United States over whether or not to tear down statues to historical racists like Jackson. U.S. President Donald Trump has strongly defended Jackson. When Trump became president, he hung Jackson's portrait in the Oval Office. So why does Andrew Jackson stir such opposing views among Americans? Here's Dr. Julie Reed, a historian at Penn State University in Pennsylvania and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Native Americans, which bore the brunt of Jackson's anti-Native policies.
Andrew Jackson is, like many of our presidents, I think, is complicated. Even in his own moment, he was highly controversial. He was considered incredibly passionate. He was considered overly emotional. He was considered volatile. And so to suggest that he both that he isn't important would be misrepresenting. But to suggest that even in his own moment, he was not highly controversial would also be misrepresenting his legacy as well.
Jackson was born in 1767. He became a wealthy slave owner with a large plantation in Tennessee called the Hermitage. But today, Jackson is perhaps most widely known for his brutality toward Native Americans. Jackson championed the Indian Removal Act, which resulted in tens of thousands of Native American Indians being forcibly removed from their land to make way for white settlers. In the violence, disease, and starvation that followed, thousands of Native people died.
I can't say that there's a single Cherokee who hasn't gone to the Hermitage and had a really visceral response. there's a kind of running joke that all of us have spit on his grave. I think for Cherokee people, it feels particularly personal in that Cherokees were allies of Andrew Jackson during the War of 1812. They fought side by side with him, only to have his legacy be to turn around and demand more land from allies. But added to that, he ushered in a policy that led to wide-scale death and destruction. It was a vast array of Native peoples who faced loss of life and loss of land as a result of Andrew Jackson.
Reed says that it's not a surprise that Jackson's legacy of violence against Native Americans is being talked about today amid the mass protests demanding an end to police violence and racism against Black people.
So in this particular moment where we're talking about the death of George Floyd, at the hands of police, at the hands of state actors, there was a very similar policing happening in the lead up to Indian removal. Native peoples didn't have recourse in the courts if they were raped, if they were beaten, if they were assaulted. They couldn't count on state legislatures to act on their behalf. And then if we think about what happens to the land, right, that is taken from Native peoples, it results in a massive expansion of plantation slavery. So this impacts everyone that is in this discussion right now, right? That African Americans have a personal experience of Jackson as a result of removal, but so do Native people.
But why is Jackson such an appealing figure for Trump? Reed says both men support a strong executive branch of government and were highly sensitive to how they were portrayed in the media. But the parallels between Trump and Jackson soon unravel.
Jackson at least had a military background. Trump can't say that. Jackson at least had performed in other types of public service as governor in Florida. He had other kinds of expertise. Trump can't say that.
So should there be a monument to Jackson in front of the White House? Reed points out that any monument gives a, quote, false tale of history, end quote. The statue by the White House, for instance, makes Jackson look like a hero, though Jackson was controversial even in his own lifetime. Still, Reed says it is fitting that Jackson is at the center of the United States' ongoing reckoning with its painful past.
There's no doubt that Indian removal was a policy of what we would consider today ethnic cleansing. And there's no doubt that even the people that lived in that moment understood, certainly after the first removal of Native peoples took place, that there was going to be a massive loss of life. And I think that the calculations were that that was okay because some people's lives didn't matter as much. And I think living in a moment of pandemic and we're living in a place of thinking about state violence, we're really muddling through some of the same questions about whose loss of life is okay for us as a country? Who are we willing to sacrifice? And for many of us, we're saying we don't want to do the same things we've done in the past. We want to do it differently moving forward. And other people are willing to say, well, certain people's lives don't matter or don't matter as much, and we're willing to make those sacrifices. And so I think Andrew Jackson is kind of an embodiment of this kind of central moral questions that we continue to face about whose lives and whose participation in our country matter and whose don't.
Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
It's not just Confederate statues and African Americans who are speaking out over painful reminders from historical figures in America's past. Protesters in Minnesota on June 10th pulled down a statue of Christopher Columbus outside the state capitol amid continuing anger over the death of George Floyd and racial injustice, which triggered massive protests across the U.S. and around the country. Activists threw a rope around the 10-foot bronze statue of Columbus and pulled it off of its stone pedestal. Protesters said they consider Columbus a symbol of genocide against Native Americans. Now, potential charges could be coming against at least one of those involved. Mike Forcia, a member of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. Our next guest is representing Forcia amid the impending charges. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice joins us now from Minnesota. Jack, give us a summary of what this case is all about.
My client is the head of the American Indian Movement in the Twin Cities. And in the shadow of the murder of George Floyd, I think there's a lot of people who feel that their voice has been ignored across the country, but here in Minnesota as well. The allegations are that my client and others pulled down a statue of Christopher Columbus on the Capitol Mall in St. Paul. On the front of this statue, it says Columbus discovered America. And there's a presumption among some people that that is the case. The problem for the Native American community here, and I think across the country, is that these people were here long before Christopher Columbus was. And the idea that he simply came here and found this place empty is simply untrue. From their perspective, he came here, and as a result of he and others, they were wiped from the map, and they have paid the price. And that's why they're angry. That's why they're upset.
And they want this statue to remain down in the city. Is potentially going to charge him?
Right now, the investigation is continuing, but my perception is that my client will be charged in this case in the county in which the Capitol is located. And it's likely going to be a felony.
What would his defense be?
In this case, it's difficult to tell. First of all, I think what we have to look at is exactly what the charges could be. One of the issues that I'm looking at in my client's case is something called restorative justice, the concept of actually bringing the major players together to talk about what happened, why it happened, and is there a way forward to pull it out of the criminal justice system and to look at it differently?
These statues, certainly the Confederate statues that have been coming down, African Americans say they're painful. They're glorifying a time that was tragic. They don't want them glorifying. I would imagine it's probably also a similar feeling among the American Indians.
It is. There are some who are saying that taking a statue down erases history. I don't think that's the case at all. I think the real purpose here is about understanding and articulating what actually happened and revising this, rethinking about what this actually means. That's what I think my client is interested in doing. That's what I think the Native American community has been trying to do now for decades here in Minnesota. And I know that's true across the country. So I think that's what we're really pushing for.
Christopher Columbus, we have a Columbus Day celebrating the man that I know Native Americans do not see as anything to celebrate. The president of the United States, similarly to what you just said, has been very angered by the removal of statues, saying we are not going to erase history, including statues of people who were slave owners, or I'm sure the same would hold true for Columbus.
The president said he wanted to protect our culture. Those were his words. The problem is whose culture is that? I think there's been a reconsideration of a whole bunch of the statues that we've had up, all of the Confederate statues, but there's more than that. And this is certainly one of those, because this is about who we are and what we stand for. When you put something in stone, when you put something in bronze, it lasts and it creates a momentum of its own. What's critical here is that we understand the history of this man, what he actually did for America, and if you will, to America and to those who lived on the continent. And that this is about accuracy and understanding. It's not just about holding somebody up as some sort of mythical hero, something that he never actually was. It's about telling the truth, finally.
What about the argument that it isn't necessarily glorifying, it is remembering, and that this is also a way to remember the not so good things that may have happened at the beginning of this country?
It's incredibly important to know who we are and to know what we stand for. But what I think is also critically important is to realize when we make mistakes, we have to rectify those mistakes. We have to revise those mistakes. Remember, yes, but rethink, reconsider, and then come up with the right answer. And in this case, Christopher Columbus should have come down. Christopher Columbus should come down.
So what is the city of Minneapolis? It doesn't know what it's going to do as far as the statue, I take it.
What some people have said is, well, he should have gone through the process. What we now know is that, in fact, there is no process. They have never taken down a statue before. And in fact, they have no process in place. There's nowhere to go for my client or for anybody else to go to the Capitol and say, I want this statue removed. If they had had something in place, I can tell you the Native American community has been upset about this for years. They had nowhere to go. If they had a process, it's possible that this never would have happened, and they would have followed it to get this removed properly. But there was no process.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thank you so much for being with us. Keep us posted on developments in this case. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Hong Kong police have fired water cannons, shot tear gas, and arrested nearly 200 people Wednesday as protesters took to the streets in defiance of sweeping security legislation introduced by China that critics say is aimed at snuffing out dissent. Beijing unveiled the details of the much-anticipated law late Tuesday after weeks of uncertainty in China's freest and one of the world's most glittering cities. Russian election officials say voters have approved amendments to the country's constitution that will allow President Vladimir Putin to stay in power until 2036. But the week-long balloting was tarnished by widespread reports of pressure on voters and other irregularities. VOA's International Edition continues. A Native American tribe in northern New Mexico has opened a film studio in a former casino. As VOA's David Byrd reports, Camel Rock Studios hopes to offer opportunities for Native people and for Hollywood.
The Tesuque Pueblo sits near the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and looks like something out of an old Western. Dusty brown soil, jagged rocks, and endless skies. Film buffs might recognize it as the setting for the 1955 Jimmy Stewart film The Man from Laramie and 1988's Young Guns. Both were filmed there. Now members of the Pueblo hope more movies will be made there after they converted a former casino into a movie studio. Camel Rock Studios, named for a nearby outcropping that resembles the desert animal, features more than 2,300 square meters of shooting space and has nearly 6,900 hectares of land on the Pueblo for films. The move comes after Universal Pictures sought to rent space for its movie News of the World, starring Tom Hanks, which is due out in December. After touring the facility, Universal decided to film the entire movie there. Tante Vigil is with the Pueblo of Tesuque Development Corporation.
This studio is one of the only that we know of Native American studios within the United States, so we're very proud. We're very proud to be one of the first studios to be open. I know the governor thinks that this is a great opportunity for the Pueblo to get in this type of industry, because it's the market is really open right now, and they want to bring in different types of businesses to the public.
Chris Ayer, a Cheyenne and Arapaho filmmaker and consultant to Camel Rock Studios, says the location offers everything movie makers could want, including pre-built sets, production offices, lots of parking, and a filming water tank, the only one of its kind in the state.
But the unique thing about this, because it was a converted casino, is that we have standing sets here. You can see that there's something that looks like a hotel lobby check-in. There are restaurants, there are bars, there's a stage for performance, there's a small area that could be a cafe. And so there's all sorts of interesting practical standing sets that can be creatively put towards all sorts of different scenes for production.
The Pueblo is also hoping to take advantage of a filming boom in New Mexico. Last year, Netflix bought Albuquerque Studios, the state's largest soundstage complex. NBC Universal has announced plans to build a TV and film studio in Albuquerque as well. Pueblo of Tesuque Development Corporation President and CEO Timothy Brown says he hopes that filmmakers will make a long-term commitment to the new studio.
You know, less tenants, longer period of time, you know, is perfect. So, you know, it's not any more complicated than that. You know, and, you know, high budget has more money and, you know, will use more of the facility and, you know, the tribe will benefit from that.
For now, Camel Rock Studios is only taking reservations for filming. The Pueblo and most of New Mexico remain under strict COVID-19 restrictions, and all movie productions are on hold. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
How does it best?
And And finally, 5 years after taking Broadway by storm with its multiracial hip-hop take on America's founding fathers, Hamilton arrives in millions of homes around the world on Friday as a film. Shot over 3 days in 2016, the stage musical featuring the original cast, the film lands on the Disney Plus streaming service as America celebrates Independence Day weekend. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
When a hurricane came, devastation rained, our man saw his future drip, dripping down the train. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain. Well, the word got around.